Let me just tell you about how I handle the holiday times. I love all the festivities, love all the decorations, love all of the food, love the presents, all the things that we like about the holiday season. I'm there for it. It is true that each year in the first week or two of December, as I see all of the, you know, the sappy sentimentality and there's all the songs, there's a little bit of me that, there's just a little Scrooge that comes out on some things, especially with some Christmas songs. So let's just talk about a few of them for a moment. Can I just settle something for us once for all? Of all people, Mary knew. She knew. There, it's in the Bible. There was a visit from an angel. Details were exchanged. This wasn't vague. Just go read her song in Luke. I mean, you wouldn't ask that question to a man, would you? Go ask Joseph if he knew. Mary knew. Then there's the song, Away in a Manger. And there's a line in that song about the baby Jesus. No crying he makes. Come on. Like, the incarnation means that he was fully human, and I don't think it's a sin to cry, and I'm pretty sure at some point Jesus was crying. Now, Peter was on his best behavior this morning. Peter was awesome, but Peter cries some, right? I mean, Peter's a normal child. They do this. We don't need to make Jesus into some baby that never cried. He cried. It's okay. And then just the manger scene in general. Everyone's so peaceful. They're gathered around. The animals are lowing. And Joseph's just proud. And Mary's not tired at all in any of these scenes. Everyone's just so proud and peaceful and happy at the manger scene. Now, I know, because I've had firsthand conversations with my esteemed predecessor, that I'm not the only preacher here who's had hot takes about the manger scene. I'm pretty sure Wade had some opinions about when you put the baby Jesus in the manger in the Advent and Christmas season. I've heard. We've talked. And then just, let's talk about the Magi for a moment. So the manger scenes have got everyone gathered, and we're pulling from Luke and Matthew and all these scenes, and the Magi are right there at the manger scene with the shepherds. And when we study history, we learn that Matthew's account has got a little bit of a different timeline. He talks about the Magi. They're probably not there at this moment in the stable seeing the baby Jesus. The Magi do not belong at the birth of Jesus. And that's the story I want to talk to us about today. Matthew chapter 2 includes the story and the song, really, that we just sang. And I'm grateful to Jeff and our praise team for indulging me in singing that song to lead into this sermon. Matthew begins his story in a way that sounds completely reasonable. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod. That's where you would expect a story like this to begin. If a king has been born, you would expect the existing king to know about it and be involved. And it's not just the king who is involved here. Matthew tells us that Herod gathers the chief priests and the scribes of the people. Basically, he calls together the Bible professors and the clergy. Which also makes sense. If Israel's Messiah has arrived, these are the people that you would want in the room. Herod is the king of the Jews. The priests know Israel's worship. The scribes know their scriptures. And so they know the story. And they know the promises. And they know what to look for. So when Herod asks where the Messiah is to be born, the answer comes pretty quickly. They open their Bibles, turn to the book of Micah, and the answer is there. Bethlehem. There's no argument, no uncertainty, just scripture. And at this point in the story, everything seems properly aligned. Authority is present. Knowledge is present. The right people are gathered. So the next logical step would be for this group to go to Bethlehem. It should be easy. It's about a 6-mile journey. It makes sense that the religious and political leaders of Israel would go to visit Israel's new king. These are the people who seem most prepared for a moment like this. Except they never quite make it there. In fact, they don't even start on that journey. Because this story isn't that simple. And it's not neat and tidy. And so we need to rewind a bit. Herod and the Bible professors and the clergy don't hear about Jesus' birth from a card in the mail or a post that they're scrolling through. They hear about it from a different source. Magi from hundreds, maybe 1,000 miles away. Now, who are these people? Some sort of combination between an astronomer and an astrologer. I know these days those two groups wouldn't want to be mixed up together, but that's who they were. Wise men is what we have called them sometimes. Kings, not sure. Matthew doesn't say that. But they're definitely not from Israel. They're not Jewish. They're from the east, Babylon or somewhere near there. And they have no reason to care about or pay attention to the king of the Jews. And yet they see a star. And they just know something. That's what they tell Herod. They say in Matthew 2:2, "Where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." These outsiders saw a star and they decided to follow it, not just across town, but for a trek that was close to 1,000 miles. That'd be like us going to El Paso and then doing it again. They didn't do it on paved roads. They didn't even know where they would end up. But they're on a caravan that could travel 15, maybe 20 miles on a good day. So this journey didn't take hours. It took days and weeks and months. Months of waking up and choosing to keep going. Months of dust and heat and doubt. Months of asking, are we still sure about this journey? All because they saw a light and they decided it was worth following. So they arrive and ask Herod, the king of the Jews, where the king of the Jews is. And I wonder what Herod's thinking at this point. You're looking at him? I don't know who else would be the king of the Jews because I'm the only one. And what's worse, the Magi don't just come looking for this new king of the Jews. They want to worship him. And that gets all over Herod. Matthew says he is disturbed. That's pretty tame. That's why Herod calls together the Bible professors and the clergy. He wants to get his scripture and his prophecy and his geography nailed down. So then he turns back to the Magi and he says, "Go to Bethlehem and find out where this child is so that I can, you know, worship him." And so these Magi, these wise men, they begin the last leg of their journey, 6 miles from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. And Matthew continues the story. "The star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh." So they see the light, the star, again. They're overjoyed, and they find the house. And they see the mother, and then they see the child, and they worship him. They bow down, and they open their luggage, and they present him with gifts for a king. Herod and Israel's leaders wouldn't go 6 miles to see Israel's Messiah. That's a short walk. It's an afternoon trip. They never go. But these magi, these Gentiles, these foreigners, the people with no standing in Israel's story, they go 1,000 miles plus six. They follow the star. They arrive at the house. They see the child with his mother, and they worship. Herod and Israel's leader wouldn't travel 6 miles. The Magi outsiders travel 1,000. Which brings us back to the line we started with. The Magi don't belong at the birth of Jesus. Israel's leaders do. But Matthew is showing us in this story that belonging has very little to do with proximity or position or even knowledge. It has everything to do with whether you're willing to follow the light. So this reversal, these unexpected worshipers, they're not random. These gifts don't just show up out of nowhere. All of this is fulfilling prophecy from hundreds of years before, when Isaiah told the people to expect this. The last part of the book of Isaiah, scholars sometimes call it 3rd Isaiah, is dealing with the return of God's people from captivity. So in 587, the Babylonians come in and conquer the city of Jerusalem and the whole nation of Judah. And 50 years later, the people who were deported in that event are returning home. But what they see in their city is not what they remember. The temple is burned, houses are in shambles, and they think that it looks like a ghost town. What they return to is not very bright. And it's into that situation that this part of Isaiah speaks. Isaiah chapter 60, beginning in verse 1. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth. Thick darkness is over the peoples. But the Lord rises upon you, and his glory appears over you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. So Isaiah is telling the people, look up from the rubble. Look past the smoke. There has been darkness, but the light of the Lord is rising. Nations will come to your light. Kings are going to show up to your new morning. This is Isaiah's way of saying foreign nations and their kings used to be a threat, and now they're going to serve you. He keeps going. To you the riches of the nations will come. Herds of camels from Midian and Ephah. Sheba will come bearing gold and incense and proclaiming the praise of the Lord. By the way, when you see camels in nativity scenes, that's not coming from Matthew. That's coming from Isaiah. You're going to have ships from Tarshish and lumber from Lebanon, flocks from here, rams from there, and not just supplies and gifts. Isaiah concludes saying that the children of your oppressors will come bowing before you. Oppressors like Babylon. So for a people who had spent generations being conquered and oppressed, this was news of stunning hope. There's a tension, though, hiding in all this good news, because Isaiah imagines foreigners coming, but on Israel's terms. These foreigners come bearing gifts and acknowledging Israel's God and fitting neatly into Israel's story. Matthew's story sounds a lot like Isaiah 60, with gold and incense, with foreigners and worship. But Matthew's story does not unfold the way people would have expected. I've been reading the past year or two from a sociologist named Ryan Burge. And Ryan does a lot of studies about just the makeup of American Christianity and what people are believing, what kinds of people are active in church these days, what aren't. A lot of stats that are meaningful there for church leaders. But what he has reminded me of, or really shown me, is that church is becoming a place mostly filled with people who have done life, quote unquote, the right way. College, career, marriage, family, people who tick all those boxes. In fact, just this week he had a chart out talking about high schoolers and church attendance. The better their grades, the more frequently they attend church. And a lot of that sounds good, but what his research has shown me, and I have mixed feelings about this, because it seems like the people who struggle to find a place in church are the ones whose lives didn't unfold that neatly. Which means the people that Isaiah imagine showing up as grateful guests often feel like disruptions when they show up. We love the idea of outsiders being welcomed as long as it doesn't unsettle the insiders. We want to imagine our churches as places where anyone would feel comfortable. I believe we really mean that. But if we're not careful, church just ends up looking like a bunch of people who look like us and dress like us and talk like us and act like us. So yes, Isaiah 60 is good news. And Matthew 2 is good news. And together, they answer a concern we all have. God's light doesn't exist to confirm what we already have. It exists to draw in people who never thought they belonged. See, there's a danger when we just focus on this serene nativity scene with everyone at peace and harmony and all is well. We miss the scandal. We miss the welcome. Because Israel's political leaders weren't there. Their religious leaders weren't there. The insiders, the ones who'd, quote, done life right, they weren't just apathetic about it. They were reluctant, even hostile. Instead, the people who were there were the magi, the foreigners, the outsiders. They didn't know the scriptures. I don't think they'd ever read Micah or Isaiah. They weren't waiting with bated breath on Israel's Messiah. The Magi don't belong at the birth of Jesus. But it's for a different reason. See, some of you are sitting here today and you feel like outsiders. You haven't read Isaiah or Micah. You don't know what to make of a lot of the religious jargon that you hear. You don't know how to do church. And at this point, you're probably afraid to ask. You are who this story is for. That is what Matthew is teaching us with this story. Because the story says you're already closer than you think. So if you feel late to the game, if you feel left out, if you feel unsure, then today's story is for you. The Magi don't belong at the birth of Jesus. And Matthew seems to agree. But the gospel keeps telling a different story. That the people who don't belong are the ones God is determined to include. Which means the Magi aren't just unwelcome outsiders. They are essential in this story. Because the Magi, these foreigners, these outsiders who don't belong, who show up at the birth of Jesus, they're the ones who show us what Christmas is really about. Let's stand and sing.